And if all goes according to plan, this is the last lecture of the first part of the course, which is introductory things about differential geometry. Then starting next week, we start actually looking at physical applications of the things we've seen so far. Before we start, are there any questions about the topics from last time? Okay, naturally, one other thing before we start. Have you all seen differential forms before, one way or another? Or is there anyone who has not seen differential forms? Okay, so I assume you've all seen them, so I don't need to spend too much time on it. I'm still going to go through the steps, so we are all on the same page with notation and so on. So first of all, we need to introduce some new kind of abuse of notation. Remember that if T is a tensor in, say, this space, T0, S, at the point A, to a manifold, we can think of this as T is a map that goes from TAM times TAM S times to R. So a tensor is something that acts on vectors. Now, it would be nice if a tensor field, we want to call this TA so we know that it is at a point. It would be nice if T, which is, say, a map that goes from M, and more generally to some from some open subset of M to the tangent bundle, the tensor bundle. So if this is now a tensor field, it would be nice if a tensor field acted on vector fields. But the way it looks like T is a map that takes points in the manifolds to tensors. So if we want T to act on vector fields, we need to define this action. And because we don't want to introduce lots of symbols and every time we do something like this, we'll use the abusive notation that we pretend that T acts on vector fields. So if x1 to xs are vector fields, then we say that T acting on x1 to xs, and I'll put it in quotes because T is not a function of these things, but we interpret it this way, is simply going to be a vector field. So this is going to be the point A. So we want this to be a function. The idea is that if a tensor acts on vectors and spits out a number, a tensor field should act on vector fields and spit out a function, which is like a zero field. So we want this to be a function, and the way we'll define it is that T x1 to xs evaluated at point A is going to be given by A. We're just going to give it a T A evaluated at x1 A xs A. So we just define it pointwise. At each point, it gives us the actual tensor at the point evaluated at the vectors at the point. This one is well defined and it's a real number. So technically, you would have needed some kind of notation that takes T to a map that acts on vector fields and that spits out a function, and you define the function this way. But it would be ugly. So as long as we know what you're doing, we can use this notation to make things clear. Any questions on this? Yes?
You use the same kind of notation to denote a vector field acting on a function.
So you're thinking the same kind of notation for a vector field acting on a function. Yes, that's true. So we have not used this kind of abusive notation at this point, but you can also use, so as another abusive notation. If X is a vector field, then we can define the action of X on a function f. Because remember, vectors at the point are derivations, they act on functions, and they spit out numbers. So you can think of a vector field acting on a function as spitting out another function. So this is the function defined by xf evaluated at a equals x at point a acting on f. So yes, it's exactly the same idea. So this is another kind of abusive notation that people use, but it's not useful for us today. The reason why we're using that one is that then it's easier to talk about a tensor being at least symmetric. Because now if you want to say T is antisymmetric, you think of it as antisymmetric when it acts on vector fields. Otherwise, T is a function of points. What does it mean for it to be antisymmetric? It only gets one input. Okay, so let me formalize this definition. A K-form on M is a totally antisymmetric tensor field on M of type 0k. So it's going to be a tensor field type 0k, but it needs to be totally antisymmetric in the sense that when it acts on vector fields, it does that antisymmetrically. When acting on vector fields. And here, totally antisymmetric means that if we swap any two indices, we're going to get a minus sign. And if you want to be more precise, and we're going to need this for the following, in general, is if we do a permutation of the inputs of the function, if the permutation is an even permutation, nothing changes. If it's odd, you're going to get a minus sign. So specifically, this means that if sigma in Sk is a permutation, Sk is what we call the symmetric group. Let me write it here, what it is. Sk is the set of all the functions, sigma that goes from the set 1 to k to the set 1 to k, which maps I to the thing we call sigma I, which is invertible. So we think of permutations as simply maps that take a set of indices and map them into themselves in an invertible way, which means that nothing maps, no two things map to the same thing. So you can think of that as a reshuffling, because you're going to get 1 to k, and they're going to be mapped to, if it's again 1 to k, then it's just identity. Maybe you reverse them, or you swap two things, and so on. So if sigma is a permutation, and omega is a k-form, if omega acting on x, sigma 1, x, sigma k, is the same as the sine of sigma times omega x1 to xk. And the sine of sigma is plus 1 for even permutations. And minus 1 for odd permutations. Are you all familiar with even and odd permutations? It's just to formalize this idea and allow more general things, but you can just think of how many swaps do you need to obtain that same permutation. If it's an even number of swaps, then you get plus 1. If it's an odd number of swaps, you get minus 1. And just as final notation, the set of all k forms is denoted by omega k in this course. Other people have other notations. So for k forms, we always think of them as being tensor fields. We don't have, you could talk about the notion of a k form at the point, but we don't, because k form field is a terrible name. So I just call them k forms, they are automatically fields. One last thing, by convention, the zero forms are just functions. So I'm just going to say that the zero forms are the special case in which you consider functions from the manifold to R. So they don't actually act on vectors. You can think of them as something that acts on zero vectors. They are the field equivalent of scalars, because there's something that at each point assigns a number. This is just for simplicity. It makes things a lot simpler to consider functions or forms. It's pretty much the same thing as saying 0 factorial is 1. It's just a convention that makes all the other formulas a lot simpler. OK, and locally, if u, phi, and phi is of the form x1 to xn is a chart, we can always say that, in general, omega is going to look like omega I1 to yk dx I1 tensor all the way to dx. Yk. This is just because it's a tensor. You can always write tensors of type 0k in such a form locally. And now the fact that this is totally antisymmetric means that omega I sigma 1 I sigma k is going to be the sine of sigma times omega I1 to yk. So again, if I do a permutation of the indices of omega, then you're going to get a minus sign if you do an odd number of permutations, plus one otherwise. And on top of this tells you that if any two of the indices are the same, then this must be zero. Because then if you permute them, you're supposed to get minus the same thing, but it's equal to the same thing, so it must be zero. One of the nice things about differential forms is that we can extend them on top of being just a subspace, seen as a vector space, of the set of all possible tensor fields of type 0k. We already mentioned that that's a vector space. This is going to be a subvector space because it's still a vector space. If you sum differential forms, they're still differential forms, and so on. But on top of that, we can extend them with extra operations. So one thing we can do is introduce the wedge product. The wedge product is a way of taking a form of rank P, or a P form, and one of rank Q. They don't have to be the same. And out of these two, we're going to build something which has a bigger rank, so it lives in here. So if you want to think of this as actually being a product on a certain space, because this takes things in here, they're not the same space, goes something that's even outside both of them. If you want to think of it as a product on a vector space, you need to take the combination of all possible forms. So you're going to have the space that has zero forms, one forms, two forms, and so on. But we don't need to go there. We don't actually care about the actual algebraic structure. So one thing that you could think of is, well, the tensor product does the same thing. Tensor product takes two tensors of certain ranks, and they make it into a bigger tensor. But the tensor product of two differential forms, so if alpha and beta are differential forms, in general, alpha times beta is not always a differential form. So the tensor product kind of looks like it will do the same thing, but it doesn't work because we need to make sure that the output is still antisymmetric. So in general, that doesn't work. So we define something similar but at the same time different, which is the wedge product. Now there are a few ways to define the wedge product. The simplest thing we can do is define it directly in coordinates. It's not my favorite thing of defining it, but also it's the faster one. The other one is going to take a lot more to go through. But if you're interested, ask me at the end of the lecture, I'll just tell you what it looks like. So in coordinates, again, we're going to use this chart. I'm going to define these things. I'm going to say that the xi1 wedge, the xi2 wedge, the way to dx ik, I'm going to define this thing, which at this point is a symbol. We're not actually taking products of things, and just taking a whole thing, giving it this name. This is going to be the sum of all possible permutation of k elements. And then we're going to do the sine of the permutation times dx i1 tensor dx i2 tensor all the way to dx ik. So again, these are symbols. This thing is a k-form because you can see by the definition that if you swap two indices, because of the fact that you are already summing over all possible permutations, that's going to give you a minus sign. And now that we have this, we'll notice, first of all, that these objects generate all of the k-forms locally. So this locally generates and to see why, we start from a k-form, the general shape that's that one. So omega is omega i1 to ik dx i1 tensor all the way to dx ik. And then we notice that, first of all, if you sum over all possible permutations, you just get an extra k factorial. Or we can just divide by k factorial and then do the sum over sigma in sk, and then we write omega I sigma 1 I sigma k dx I sigma 1 tensor dx I sigma k. And this is simple because sigma is invertible. So every time I'm just renaming things, but I'm still summing over them. They're dummy indices. So for every sigma, this is actually the same sum. So sigma k as k factorial elements, because they're k factorial possible permutations of k elements. So this just gives an extra k factorial. But now we remember that this thing here is totally antisymmetric. It's actually written right there. So this is 1 over k factorial, the sum over sigma, and then we get omega i1 to ik times the sine of sigma, and then we get dx I sigma 1. This should have been sigma 1, sigma 2 to sigma k all along. Otherwise, we're just summing the same thing over and over again. X I sigma k, and then the sum over sigma of this thing is that symbol with the wedge that we defined. So in general, this is just 1 over k factorial omega I1 to ik dx I1 wedge dx ik.
Giuseppe, I had a question.
Yes.
So what does it mean for us to index these dx's and omegas with I sigma? Because sigma is, as I understand, is like a string of length k.
Yes.
So I don't really see why we're labeling it with the...
So the reason why we're labeling them is that sigma 1, in general, let's write this somewhere else. So in general, sigma I is an element of the set 1 to k. So when I write, maybe I'm using a different thing, let's say sigma, I'm going to use capital indices just so we don't get confused. So when I write I sigma capital I, this is going to be something that lives in I1 to ik. So that's why I'm doing it that way. You could try to do sigma of I1, but actually that doesn't work. Because your indices, often we just say, okay, so x goes from x1 to xn, but in special relativity or general relativity, you say x0 to xn minus 1, for example. So just to avoid all of this confusion, and also to make sure that the indices that you feed into sigma are all different, then we're just going to do sigma 1 to sigma k, because those are all well defined, they're all different. While I sigma capital I, they need not all be the same. So for example, I1 to ik could all be the same thing, could all be 1. So this is gives us more generality.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So these symbols that we defined provide the local, it's the equivalent of a local frame, it just, we don't call it frame because that's only for vector fields, but it's a local generator of all possible k-forms. One thing to note about this is that the number of independent ones is not k. So you might think there are, well, it's not just k, it's not k times n, which will be for tensors. So for a tensor field, for the space of tensor fields of type 0k, there are n times k generators. Or in our case, it's k to the n generators. In our case, though, they are not all independent because of the anti-symmetry property. So we can swap some things around, or if you want, dx1 tensor dx2 is independent from this other tensor. These two tensor fields are independent from each other because they act differently. You cannot get the action of this one from the action of this one. But because of the anti-symmetry, if you replace these with wedges, then they're just the same up to a minus sign. So in general, to find the independent ones, we're just going to impose that I1 is less than I2, less than IK. So we're just going to order them so that all the indices are one less than the other. And then there's only one way of doing this. You cannot swap them, because if you swap them, some of the indices are going to change signs. And they cannot be equal, because if any two of them are equal, then you're going to get zero, because of the fact that they're antisymmetric. So now, if you're going to look at all the possible ways of getting k elements out of n in such a way that they're ordered, this is just n choose k. Because the first one that we take is going to, well, say we take the biggest one, there's going to be k ways of doing that. Then you remove that, there's k minus one ways, and so on. So eventually you end up with n choose k. Okay, so this is just something useful to know. And this tells you that k forms and n minus k forms have the same number of generators. So it turns out that there's an isomorphism between them. But it's going to depend on the basis that you choose. So if you want this to be a natural or canonical kind of isomorphism, you need extra information, such as a metric. But this is not something we need at this point. Any questions so far? Okay, so I didn't actually tell you fully how this product works, because so far we only had the symbols. So more generally, if alpha is a form that looks like this, you have alpha I1 to IP dx I1 wedge dx IP. And they all locally look like this, because these objects form not really bases, but they are generators for them. And beta looks like this, beta J1. To JQ, and P and Q don't have to be the same. DX J1 to DX JQ. If I want to define the product, I'm going to say that this is alpha I1 to IP, beta J1 to JQ, and then I have dx I1 wedge dx IP wedge dx J1 all the way to dx JQ. So in general, you get a P plus Q form. And you can check that this is still a form because of the antisymmetry coming from these things. One thing to note is that if I write it in this way, these things here don't actually have to be antisymmetric, because all the antisymmetry is in here. If I swap two indices, the antisymmetry comes from that. But if it's symmetric, if it's not antisymmetric, any symmetric part does not matter at all, because then you can write this as antisymmetric plus symmetric part. The symmetric part gives you zero, because you have multiplying a symmetric thing by an antisymmetric thing. So when you want to make sure that this is indeed a form, you just need to check that this is antisymmetric in the indices, and then whether this times this is symmetric or antisymmetric doesn't actually matter. Any questions about how this thing is defined? Yes?
Can I split every Q index object into symmetric and antisymmetric part?
So you want to split n? Are you trying to split this thing?
Yeah, or? Like for two indices, I can always do it, but for more indices, like how do I like split it into symmetric and antisymmetric part?
Good question. You can use the symmetrization and the antisymmetrization thing, so you can still do it. Well, that's a good question. I don't know. That's a good point. I'm not entirely sure if you can split it, but the point here is that this doesn't have to be antisymmetric. Right? It is possibly not always possible for Q things to always write it as symmetric plus antisymmetric. But only the antisymmetric part is going to matter. So anything that's not the antisymmetric part doesn't matter. You can always anti-symmetrize things. And you can also always symmetrize things. Well, I'm not entirely sure that it's always true that it's the sum of the two things. Yes?
I think you just have to symmetrize with respect to two indices. As long as two indices, when you swap them, you don't get a minus. Then when you swap the two indices in the wedge product, then you cancel this contribution. So I think in general you cannot split it in like symmetric and antisymmetric, but it's you can still split it in partially symmetric and fully antisymmetric.
Yes, it's sort of, because it's like mixed symmetry, right?
Yes, it's something like that. Yeah, I didn't fully think of this before. This is what happens when you improvise during lectures. I did not plan on saying this thing. I just realized it as I was looking at it, and I thought, oh, I'll spell them. This will teach me. OK. Other than that, are there any other questions? OK, so this is how you define these wedge products. There's a few properties that are very useful. The wedge product is linear, as it's easy to see just by the way it's defined. It doesn't really matter for us, but it's just an associative product. And it has this property that alpha times beta, if I try to swap beta and alpha, I get potentially a minus one sign. I'm going to do the notation here. I'm going to denote by this absolute value of a form is the rank of the form. So if beta is a Q form, then the rank of beta is Q. Just so that I don't have to say let alpha be a P form, beta be a Q form, and then I have to say P and Q. So you get this times beta wedge alpha. So it's not always commutative and it's not always anticommutative. It depends on the ranks of alpha and beta. So this is what is called a graded algebra, because you have, depending on the ranks of things, you may get a minus sign when you swap stuff. And you're actually already familiar with these things because this is what happens with fermions. And in fact, if you want to formalize the idea of Grassmann algebra, then something that has a wedge product is exactly something like that. When you multiply two fermions, you are thinking something like a wedge product. And if I have two of them and I swap them, then you get a minus sign. But if you have the product of two of them and you try to swap it with something else, then swapping those things will actually be three swaps, and then you actually get, two swaps, and then you get the plus sign. And finally, and this is a very important one, if F is a map from a manifold to another manifold, and as usual, we'll assume it's smooth, then the pullback of alpha wedge beta is alpha, the pullback of alpha wedge, the pullback of beta. And in general, I didn't tell you, but this thing is still aka, well, a rank of B form. Taking the pullback of something does not change whether it's anti-symmetric or not. So in general, a pullback of a tensor field is a tensor field, and because it's still anti-symmetric in the same way, if it's a form, it still is a form. Okay, so this is everything about the wedge product. Now I do have one question for you. Why is it so important that the thing that this wedge product is acting on is differential forms, which is really tensors of type 0k, instead of the other way around? Why didn't we choose vectors and take the wedge product of vectors? Would it make sense to take the wedge product of vectors? Any ideas? Yes?
It could be naive, but isn't the fact that our basis is commutative?
Which basis are we talking about?
Vectors, like the basis elements, partials over partials, something like this. Could be naive.
So if you're thinking of taking the product of two vectors, they will need to, so take, you have one vector, one vector, you take the wedge product, it should be a tensor now. So that now the whatever generators you have are not commutative anymore.
Are you implying that like pullback for
yes
vectors is not really well defined?
Yes, so this is actually the reason why we do this for differential forms rather than vectors. Of all the properties, everything so far, if I had decided instead of starting for tensors of type 0k, I started with tensors of k0, everything else up to this very thing would have worked exactly the same. In fact, you can do that. Nothing stops you. Things like this, d over dx, I wedge d over dxj, make perfect sense. And in fact, I used. This thing is called a bivector. So there's nothing wrong with that. You can take an anti-symmetric product of tensors. You just, in the same way, I say, okay, so you have a tensor, and it's totally anti-symmetric if when it acts on covectors, because remember the vectors can act on covectors, it is totally anti-symmetric. So this part is fine. You can do almost everything but this. And this is extremely helpful, because doing the pullback of these kind of things allows us to take a structure on one manifold, bring it to another manifold. So if you go and do vector fields instead, then it doesn't work. So that's the thing that makes differential forms special, instead of just considering vector fields and their wedge products. And similarly, if you try to mix things, it's still not going to work. They need to be all contravariant vectors for this to make sense. Yes?
So can't you just push forward these things? What makes pullback special to...
Yes, so as we saw last time, the push forward only works at one point. So the push forward, you can do a push forward of a vector at a point, but you cannot, in general, push forward a vector field. If you put together all the vectors at one point that you pushed, the result is not always going to be a vector field. So if you want to do this, you need the map F to be a diffeomorphism, and then you can swap back and forth. But then you are finding a direct isomorphism between tensors of type K0 and type 0K. And then, of course, if you can map one to the other, then they are the same thing. But in general, you can't. So you can only do this if you have a way of mapping them to each other. If you have a metric, then everything is fine. If you have a metric, you can always just use the metric to pull back things, and then everything is fine. But in absence of extra stuff, differential forms have one more thing that you can do. So that's why we like them. There are things that you can do with differential forms that you cannot just do with vector fields. Not unless you have an explicit way of mapping one to the other, but that requires extra structure. Okay, there's one other operation that we can define on differential forms. I'll probably just use a different word. The other operation is called the exterior derivative. The exterior derivative is another map that takes two forms of, sorry, this one takes only one form, and it sends it to a different form of a different rank. We usually call it D, and it takes a K form to something that's a K plus one form. So it increases the rank of a form. And we call it a derivative because it's going to look like a derivative. And remember, looking at it like a derivative means, if we distill the notion of what the derivative means, it needs to satisfy some kind of product rule. And it must be a linear thing. So to define this, again, I'm going to do it in coordinates. And if you're interested in how it's done without coordinates, just ask me. This one is actually easy. In fact, I may just tell you anyway if we have time. So I'm going to define it first on zero forms. So if f is a zero form, which means f is a function, again, I'm going to define this in coordinates, then df is going to be a one form. Every one form can be written in this way. There's some object we have to decide with an index I, and then we have dxi. One forms are just the same as covector fields. So we just need to decide what goes here. And what goes here is going to be the derivative of f in coordinates with respect to y. And you can probably start seeing why we call this thing an exterior derivative, because it kind of looks like we're taking the derivative of the function f. In fact, this thing is pretty much the differential of f. It kind of looks like the gradient of f, but the gradient is a vector field. So this is not technically the thing we call the gradient. If you want to call it a gradient, you need to use something that takes you from differential forms to vector fields, and then needs some kind of structure. It can be a metric, could be a symplectic structure, but you need something to swap from one to the other. And then, if alpha looks like this, I have alpha i1 to ik dx I1 wedge dx ik. Then if I want to define the differential of A, or the stereo derivative of A, this is going to be the derivative of the coordinate expression of alpha I1 to ik over dxj, and then I have dxj wedge dxi1 wedge dxik. By convention, we do the dxj first, and then we wedge it with everything else. You could have defined it the other way around, but this is the way we usually do things. So again, it looks like a derivative because you are taking derivatives of things. And out of this, now this defines how to do the exterior product, the exterior derivative for everything you might need. And just by looking at these things, we can find the properties of this. As usual, this is linear because all you're doing is taking derivatives and wedge products, and both of those two operations are linear. And then you can check that if you take this operation twice on some differential form omega, this is always going to be zero. It doesn't matter what it is. For functions, you can see that if I do this again, I'm going to, by using this definition, I take the second derivative of f with respect to xi, xj, and then you get dxi wedge dxj. But because f at is a smooth function, the order of derivation doesn't matter. So I can swap dxi and dxj, but because one thing is symmetric, the other one is anti-symmetric, you get zero. And the same happens here, because then you're going to be able to swap, it's actually exactly the same, you get dxj1, j2, dxj1 wedge dxj2, you can swap the order, so you're always going to get zero. And finally, there's the product rule equivalent. If you try to take the derivative of alpha wedge beta and you want to relate this to the derivative of, well, you just want to write it as, ideally, you want to split up the product. So our usual product rule is you take the derivative of the first times the second plus the other way around. This is going to be d alpha wedge beta. But then we're going to have potentially a minus 1 appearing here. And it's going to be minus 1 to the degree of alpha times alpha wedge d beta. So technically, this is not a derivation, because derivations must be linear and satisfy the product rule. So instead, this is what we call an antiderivation. Because it potentially has a minus one thing. So this happens because you have the graded product structure on our space. And additionally, again, and this is why we like working with differential forms, so covectors instead of vectors, the pullback of d omega is d of the pullback of omega. So both the wedge product and the exterior derivative commute with taking pullbacks, which is a very helpful property to have. Any questions about the exterior derivative? Okay, so in case you're interested, if you wanted to define this without using coordinates, you will actually define it through axioms. So you just define it as the operation that satisfies these things, and they are pretty much the properties. So in terms of axioms, you would require that D is linear, then you would require that d alpha wedge beta is d alpha wedge beta plus minus 1. So we require the product rule with the potential minus 1. And then we need to specify. So these things allow us to extend. If you start from a 0 form, then you can go to a 1 form, and then you can go to a 2 form, and so on. But we need to know, first of all, how it acts on a 0 form. So we need to define that df is the 1 form that acts on a vector field x as x acting on f. And finally, d squared acting on a function is 0. If you put all these things together, there's only one way of doing this, and it's by defining things in this way. So that's the more general way without using coordinates of defining this thing. For this, it's easy. If you want to try it for the bridge product, it gets kind of messy. Yes?
Is there an operation that gets us from omega j plus 1 to omega j?
Yes. But you need some extra information to do that. If you wanted to go, instead of taking something that goes up, it goes down, that's called a codifferential. To do that, you need to introduce the odd product. So you need some kind of map that takes vectors into covectors. Generally, the symmetric, but you can also do the odd star connected to a symplectic structure, for example. You just need some non-degenerate two form. So once you have that, you can define a way of going back and forth, and that allows you to define something that takes k plus 1 forms to k forms. But that's not a natural thing. Everything we've done up to this point, we didn't give anything to the manifold that it didn't have just by being a manifold. All of this is just a manifold gets all of this stuff for free. But if you want to get the map that you're asking for, you don't get it for free. You need something more. OK, we just have a couple more things to say. So I think we're actually going to finish this in time. Just as a definition of things, this turns out to be very important. We say that a differential form is closed if d alpha is 0. So if you take the derivative of the exterior derivative of a differential form and you get 0, you say it's closed. And we say it is exact if alpha equals d of beta with beta in omega k minus 1 m. And it doesn't have to be unique. This is, in general, not true. Because if I take beta plus d gamma for some other gamma, then d of this thing is the same as d beta. So in general, this is not unique. But if there is one that does this, then you see it's exact. The reason why these notions are important is that, in general, exact implies closed, because d squared is 0. So if you take d squared of alpha and alpha equals, sorry, d of alpha and alpha equals d beta, that's d squared of beta, which is always 0. The other way around is not always true. So in general, closed does not imply exact, but it does on Rn. So if your manifold is just Rn, then closed actually implies exact. So every closed form is exact. And the other one is always true, so we don't have to really worry about it. So as it turns out, the difference between being whether this thing applies or not, this actually depends on the topology of the manifold. By which we mean that it actually depends on the global structure of your manifold. Remember, manifolds are things that locally look like Rn. So locally, it is true the closed implies exact. If you just look at your piece of manifold, then everything can, in that patch, everything that's closed can be written as an exact form. But if you try to do this globally over the whole manifold, so you try to pitch together all these things, then you cannot always patch them all the way around. And specifically, this fails to happen when you have some kind of holes in your manifold. So for example, if you're looking at the plane without the point, then this has a hole in the middle. Because of the hole, it's not true that, in general, closed forms are exact. This is going to be very important when, later in the course, we're going to be talking about principal bundles and gauge theory. Because when you talk about the kind of stuff, it is important what the global structure of the manifold is. That's where you get important, interesting stuff from. And this kind of notion is one of the few things we've seen so far that really depends on the global structure of the manifold. OK, so one last thing to say. This is not super important because we're not going to have time to talk about integration, but it's still a good thing to know about differential forms. We have seen that, in general, the dimension of omega k is not really the dimension, so it's really the number of generators. Of this is n choose k. And n choose k, if k increases, it first goes up, but then it goes down again. So at some point, you start getting less and less generators, and that's because of the antisymmetry. And in general, you can at most get dimension of m forms. Because you are trying to take, in terms of coordinates, they're going to be generated by dxi, wedge dxi2, and so on. But the indices only go from 1 to n. If you try to do the wedge product of more than n things, two of them must be the same. There's no way to have n plus more than n different things taken from n. So this is the best we can do. And they have dimensions, or the number of generators. So you have n choose n, which is 1, generators. So we call these kind of things top forms. Because they are the ones that you get at the top. There's nothing higher than this. And a top form always looks like this. It's some function times the x1 wedge the xn. Because there's only one generator, and it's this one. So everything else is just some function times this. And if you want to write this now, if you want to change basis, which means you change charts, you go from a chart x I to a chart y I, then you just need to change each one of these things. So you'll see that omega, or in general, we'll just look at all these changes, dx1 wedge dxn is going to be, for each one of these things, we just get a Jacobian factor. So So we get the d over d x1 over d y I1, d x2 over d y I2, d x n over d y I n, d y I1 wedge d y I n. And I don't intend to go through the steps, but because of the fact that these things are not asymmetric, eventually, and if you want the steps, they're in the lecture notes that I put on the portal, you actually end up getting the determinant of the Jacobian matrix times dy1 wedge dyn. So for top forms, changing from one to the other actually gives you the determinant of the Jacobian as your transition map. This is very important if you want to define things like integration of manifolds, because that pretty much looks like the change of coordinates formula for integrals. If you are changing coordinates, you end up with the new region of integration, then you have your dx1 dxn becomes dy1 dyn times the determinant of the Jacobian. The only difference is that in the formula, there's an absolute value of this determinant, which is important because that means you need something more than just this to define integration. Okay, this is everything I wanted to tell you about differential forms, and we'll actually finish this in time. So starting next week, we're going to see applications to physics. We're going to start with symplectic geometry, and then we'll talk about principal bundles, bundles in general, and gauge theory. Are there any questions about this or really any of the things we've done so far, since this is the end of this first part of the course? Yes?
I missed what you said about the topology of M. Did you mean to say that the closeness doesn't necessarily imply exact? Does it determine the topology of M?
It depends on the topology. So whether in general, you may ask, does closed imply exact? And the answer is, it depends on the topology. We don't have time to go over this, because if we do that, then we won't get time to talk about gauge theory, which is more interesting. But there's a whole area of differential geometry, which is called the RAM cohomology, that essentially is a study of which forms can be, well, it kind of studies to what extent this is not true. So it kind of checks, as vector spaces, how many things do you have that are closed but not exact. And this thing is what's called a topological invariant. So if two manifolds are topologically the same, then they have the same cohomology, which means they have the same properties of whether closed implies exact. So this is something that fully is specified by the topology. So it doesn't actually matter what the manifold is. What does it matter is, does the manifold have some holes? If it does, then you have this kind of problem. And what exactly a hole is, it's a topological notion that we don't have time to get into. So in that sense, this is an interesting thing to study. It's important, but then for our purposes, whenever you're working with a manifold, usually you know what kind of manifold it is. So someone's going to tell you this one is holes and this one has this property that not everything that's closed is exact. Any other questions?
how do we define the wedge product without coordinates?
So without coordinates, if you want to define a wedge product, you do it this way. And by the way, the lecture is over. If you're not interested in this, you don't have to stay. Without coordinates, the definition itself is actually very easy. The problem is if you want to go from the definition to the coordinates, it's actually quite a mess. So I was planning, well, I'll give the definition. Maybe if it's easy, I'll go to the coordinates. It's not easy. I was trying to find a way. It took me half an hour this morning before I gave up. You define it this way. So suppose that T is a tensor. So it's a 0K tensor field. And then we can anti-symmetrize it. So we define a map, which people usually call alt, that takes T to an anti-symmetric tensor, which would be a form. So this acts on x1 to xk by being the, you sum all possible anti-symmetrizations. So this would be the sum over sigma in sk. You divide by k factorial because there's k factorial of them. And then we have the sine of sigma times t of x sigma 1 x sigma k. So this part here is easy. This is the anti-symmetrization of something. And then you define alpha wedge beta as the anti-symmetrization times some stuff. So I think it's this plus this factorial divided by this factorial times this factorial alt of alpha times beta. So we mentioned that in general, alpha times beta, tensor beta, is not a differential form anymore. But if you anti-symmetrize it, then it is. So that's the usual way. The coefficients depend on your convention. Our convention is this one. Some people don't multiply by this, or just don't multiply by anything. There are different ways of defining this, depending on which property you would like to have in the end. Because we're going to deal with symplectic mechanics, and we don't want factors of two appearing everywhere, we choose this one. That's usually where people choose it, because otherwise you have lots of twos appearing in all kinds of places. Because if you choose this, dx wedge dy is going to be 1 half dx times dy minus dy times dx. And because of this 1 half, you have lots of twos appearing, otherwise 1 half, so times 2 everywhere. So our convention is instead, this is not there. It's a bit annoying in some of the things, because then it's not just, you know, the anti-symmetric thing, because usually it will take the 1 half to make things nicer, but it does make other things nicer. It's all just convention to make things easier, depending on what you're trying to do. So that's the definition. It's not complicated. You just need two lines. The problem is that if you want to go from that to dx I1 wedge dx I2 wedge dx ik equals the formula I gave you before, that's super annoying, because you kind of need to do it step by step. You first see, okay, so you have this wedge this, and then you write it as a formula, and then you need to do some kind of proof by induction, assuming that this thing looks like something. It just looks very messy. It's not something that you could have done easily in 5 minutes. So that's it. And this one doesn't use coordinates. But then this may be the one thing where I prefer to use coordinates rather than the non-coordinate version if I had to explain it to someone that doesn't know it.